What's up, Open Floor Globe? This is Ben Golliver with the Washington Post. I am joined on the other line by Michael the Pod Pina. Now, Michael, finally, after months of speculation and waiting and more speculation and more waiting, we have some official movement towards a resolution for the 2019-2020 NBA season. Over the weekend, the NBA announced in a press release that they had begun negotiations with basically the Disney company to use a campus at Walt Disney World to host a bubble-like atmosphere, a campus, if you would prefer to call it that, that would potentially take care of the upcoming playoffs and maybe even the balance or some portion of the rest of the regular season. Now, there are many unanswered questions remaining. We don't know if that will be the only campus. We don't know how many teams will be invited to the campus. We don't know if they will try to have all 30 teams go there so they can play out some of the remaining regular season games and get that the local TV money. We don't know if they'll go straight to the playoffs to try to keep the risk down for all the teams who really aren't in the picture. We don't know how strict the bubble will be. In other words, are players going to be able to come and go freely? Will families be allowed in? We don't really know yet either the specifics of the testing procedures. Obviously no one really wants to get that nasal swab test done every single day for 3 months straight. But we do know sort of timing. You know, they're aiming for a late July start to games, which means that when you're going through the ramp up process and quarantining people and everything else, that stuff's going to be happening here pretty soon, Michael, in a couple weeks probably, if they're going to hit that late July target date for games in September. We also know that if you need multiple months to play the playoffs, that means things are going to end right around the end of September. And you're going to be heading into the offseason and the draft from there, which means you're most likely pushing back the start of next season until December. So that's what we know. We finally know things, Michael. And I'm curious, from what I just laid out, is there anything that jumps out to you as sounding great or sounding positive, things that capture your attention? And then what has you maybe a little bit nervous? What's your big hang-up at this point?
Before we start, a quick question for you. Have you had the full nasal swab coronavirus test, Ben?
I have not. Thankfully, I've not had any symptoms whatsoever since the start. I've been under strict quarantine, Michael. I would say that I'm down to like two or three social interactions per week. If you're not counting me walking by people on the sidewalk, and look, I'm giving everybody big buffers, right? I'm giving lots of thumbs up, Michael, lots of head nods, but big buffers on all my walks. Besides that, you know, I get to my laundromat every once in a while and I order food in. I have to go to the bank once a month to deposit my rent check. But other than that, I am pretty locked down and safe. Have you had the nasal swab test?
So, yes, I bring this up because upon reading the first report of just all the different scenarios and permutations that would allow the season to come back, I saw the note that players were resistant to getting the test every day and how uncomfortable could it possibly be. And so I had the test done and I had I went to a local, I guess, medical center in Brooklyn to get the antibody test because my wife and I are taking a trip to we're driving to Michigan in the coming days. And I wanted to make sure that, you know, obviously we don't know everything about COVID-19 so far, but if you have already had it, then it is less likely that you are able to pass it on and get it again to other people. So I had the antibody test. I had the nasal swab test. And I just want to say that I have never had anything more painful done to me in my entire life than that swab going up my nose. So I just want to apologize to the players when I judge them upon initially reading the report. I could not even imagine getting that done ever again in my whole life.
So stop right there. How much would I need to pay you to have that test done to you every single day for 3 months straight if you're in a playoff bubble and you're playing regular season games trying to proceed towards a title? Because the problem they have right now is that the other testing methods are either not very reliable, like the instant test machines have been having some issues, and then they really wanted to do a saliva swab test, and people were pretty excited about it. But then I think there's been some more research, and that people have sort of backed off that one. as being like, you know, the Hail Mary kind of saving grace of everything. So if they are stuck with this nasal swab test, it's kind of the only thing that they have to have available for the players. And even that one still takes a while to give you results. What do you say, Michael? What dollar figure? Because obviously you survived it, right? So you could do it again if you needed to. You wouldn't want to. You would dread it every single day. How much money do I have to get you to do it every day?
I mean, the millions that the players are losing by not playing is a pretty good incentive. So I real quick, like just the quick play by play. I'm sitting in a chair in the waiting room or whatever, not the waiting room, but the room where I'm getting the test done. And the doctor is like, this is probably not going to be pleasant. And I was like, whatever, how bad could it be? She sticks it up my nose. It is very, very painful, very uncomfortable. And I thought I had a high pain tolerance before this experience. And she hands me a napkin because you involuntarily cry, I guess. And I started to cry. And then she starts doing the blood work. And she's talking to me and saying, like, we're trying to get the vein, blah, blah, blah. And I'm not even able to focus on that at all because the pain in my face is still so great. So, like, my eyes are watering, tears are coming out of my face.
Stop there. Okay. If I gave you 10 free throws at that moment, how many could you hit? No crowd because you're in an empty gym. How many do you think you could have hit at that moment?
Three or four, I would say.
So you do have a pretty high pain tolerance. If you're crying and you're doubled over in pain and you're shooting 30%, you're almost as good as Andre Drummond.
Right, but the funny part was I didn't even realize that I had blood work done until they pulled the needle out of my arm. That's how painful it was in the face. So I just want to get this anecdote out of the way before we start talking about the season coming back, because I thought it was a kind of a funny story.
No, it's a great story. It's very informative. And look, bottom line is, what percentage of NBA players or what percentage of society who hasn't had this test understands exactly what's involved with it, right? Like, it all sounds well and good to bring the game back until you show up and, you know, you're doing this every single day and you're like, wait a minute, this isn't what I signed up for. So that's going to require a real internal education campaign, or it's going to require pulling whatever possible strings they can to get better tests between now and late July. And frankly, they're going to need the test before that because they're going to have players in group activities, well before that late July timeline. So to me, the testing thing remains a major challenge in terms of how they're going to execute it. But Michael, from the plan that's been laid out, what did you like? What's got you nervous besides the nasal swab?
I mean, at the center of this is just the fundamental fact that playing games is less safe than not playing games. And you can think of every precaution in the world and account for anything going wrong as best you can. But the fact remains that the NBA is trying to play basketball games in the middle of a global pandemic. And so I feel like that just needs to be said right off the top. I think...
Because of the nature of the game, right? This idea that, hey, indoor activity is definitely higher risk than outdoor activity. Close contact activity is definitely worse than socially distanced activity. And look, Michael, you could have as much pace to space as you want. It's not socially distanced, right? I mean, this is not how it works. You're not going to have guys, and you're probably going to have them, whether it's training rooms or locker rooms. I mean, you're going to have to change all aspects of that. But just even on the court, playing, you're obviously in close proximity. You're sweating on yourself, your opponents, on the ball. And the other big issue is that a lot of players or a lot of people who get this virus are asymptomatic. So they just don't even know it. And the tests take a while sometimes to reveal it. So again, you're in a kind of a pressure cooker type environment to pass this thing on from one person to another. And that's essentially what happened, where, you know, multiple players are all testing positive, the teammates and opponents. I mean, that's not coincidental, right? We haven't contact traced all the Utah Jazz situations all the way back to the beginning, right? But it doesn't seem like it's a coincidence there. So this is pretty high risk activity. And when you're laying out, you know, all the types of things that are going to be allowed to kind of be done and reopened here across the country, this type of gathering indoors with lots of people in close proximity is one of the last things that is going to be allowed.
Yeah, and I think so. Just contextually, we should lay all that out for everyone to kind of process. But not that they don't already know it. But I do like just the baseline of the plan where, you know, they're limiting travel, they're trying to have it in one location. We've known that that would be what the league wants for quite some time, but it's good to get kind of an official statement by the NBA about it. And there's been just so many reports about the open-mindedness of the decision makers and how everyone is trying to be as flexible as possible to get it done. So again, like from the context where we already know that it is not the safest possible thing to do to play basketball right now, the fact that they are trying to put it on in as safe as a situation as possible is good. And so from that perspective, I am for it and I like it, but
yeah, let me hop on there before we get to the negatives. What I like is this idea of multiple stages, right? You're going to have a quarantine period. You're going to, you know, you're giving yourself not only kind of a smart medical way of laying things out where you're not just throwing everybody together from all over the country and saying, hey, here's the playoffs. You know, you're going to have individual teams meeting and then going through the quarantine process, you know, getting to that single site, probably quarantining again at that point. You're going to have hotels that are going to be relatively isolated and facilities that are relatively isolated from the rest of society, the rest of Disney World and everything else. So that makes a lot of sense. And these are the things all the way back in March we were saying that they were going to need to do. You know, they're not quite out on a deserted island like we were imagining, Michael, but, you know, they've got this thing down pretty close. So, you know, those things are positive and they do seem very logical. It sounds like this facility itself has the ability to play multiple games simultaneously and has room for practice gyms. So to me, it does sound pretty ideal. It sounds in some ways even better than Las Vegas, just because, you know, in Vegas, the different facilities might be independently owned, and who knows if you're going to be able to kind of lock them down to any other events. I mean, that would be kind of an open question too. So they've made some real progress here. There's no doubt. So let me ask you though, what's your hangup? I mean, what has you nervous?
I mean, what if someone gets sick? It's a really obvious question, but like, can you imagine having to deal with like the queasy platitudes where, you know, a player on the Milwaukee Bucks gets it and then it's like, oh, well, Brook Lopez couldn't be here fighting beside us, so we're going to have to go out there and win the whole championship for him. Like, it's just like that type of scenario is just kind of like gross to think about, but it is one that I could see happening, which is just, it's not what you want. I mean, last week, Jared Dudley addressed the practical concerns surrounding, you know, the basic liberties that this bubble scenario ostensibly strips from players. And if, like, you know, a player leaves and contracts the virus and then comes back and infects the team, like, what happens? Do we just pause the playoffs, or does that player get quarantined and hopefully not infect anyone else? And then you have to worry about the elderly people who are involved, like some of the coaches, some of the referees. You know, if someone is critically affected by this and is actually hospitalized, does the whole thing go on pause, or do we continue on? And it's just, that is the obvious, most pressing concern for me. And I don't know how the league can just guarantee that that will not happen.
The league can't. And Adam Silver has sort of communicated that to players, to, you know, basically, hey guys, get comfortable with this idea that we're not going to be able to guarantee your safety. If you still want to play, great. But like, you know, there's just no way where we're going to be able to make this thing, you know, 100% safe. You know, you can't make that promise up front. I guess what I like with the stages idea is it gives you off ramps, right? If something goes wrong in the more confined team by team settings early on in this process, it could give you the ability to kind of step back and scrap the whole thing. I mean, we've seen other leagues around the world kind of start and stop, right, when they're trying to do these comeback plans. And that would be a horrible PR black eye of, oh, get everybody excited for these playoffs, and then something happens during one of the quarantines, and, oh, okay, now we can't do it. But I could guarantee you there is a much worse, very realistic black eye. Someone could die here, right? I mean, it's not just that they could go get sick and they're in the hospital. Like, this is a disease that kills. And most of the players are younger and they're not at super high risk because they're fit and they most likely don't have some of the other issues that have been, you know, they don't have obesity or diabetes or, you know, major breathing problems or anything like that. But certainly there's going to be people who are on those travel teams who are older, who maybe are obese as coaches or you know, have some other issues underlying that could present greater health challenges. And so that worst case scenario needs to be discussed. It can't be glossed over as, oh, this guy's just going to be in the hospital for 3 weeks, or, oh, we're not going to hear from him for 2 weeks, sort of like, you know, Donovan Mitchell or Kevin Durant, and then all of a sudden they come back and they're okay, right? That's not how it goes every single time.
No, and then also what you need to account for, which you can't, is, you know, what if a star player's family member contracts COVID-19 who is not, like, in Orlando, who's just in their home and wherever they may be, wherever they may live, and they die from it. And, you know, we're thinking about this. This is not like this is unprecedented. Carl Anthony Towns' mother passed away a couple months ago. So what if that happens? It's a terrible tragedy, and a player just decides not to play, or he's uncomfortable continuing on. Like, that's another roadblock that you would have to kind of hop over on the fly, and it's really dark and depressing to even discuss this, but this is what you have to discuss if you want to play basketball games during a global pandemic.
Oh, it's a great point. And that's, you know, it's part of the reason why I'm in favor of only taking the 16 playoff teams. I don't think any of the lottery teams should go.
100%.
I hate to kind of hurt their feelings and send them home and, you know, just kind of dismissively say, oh, better luck next year. The fewer teams you're bringing, the less risk, significantly, right? Because you just have fewer people to account for. You have fewer variables. And the idea that you're going to be playing meaningless end-of-season regular games in these kinds of conditions, to me, it's really rough. Like, I can understand the appeal of the playoffs and, like, you know, the playoff revenue that usually gets generated, and everybody wants to crown a champion, and there's the history factor at play. There's no history in, you know, Golden State Warriors versus Minnesota Timberwolves, right? Nothing. It just does not even matter, right? So I think from that standpoint, I would only bring the 16. Sounds like you're on board with that. Michael, given that they would all be at one location, and so the travel stuff doesn't matter, would you be in favor of a 1-16 regardless of conference playoff format? So you just rank the teams by record and you know, try to juice up some more interesting first-round matchups? Or would you stick to the West versus East for tradition's sake rather than, you know, make this thing even weirder than it needs to be?
This is really interesting. I don't know where I come down necessarily with whether or not they should reseed or whether or not they should, because the number one reason why we haven't had just the basic 1-16 best regular season record postseason is because of travel, as you mentioned, and, you know, the possibility of the Portland Trailblazers having to play the Miami Heat or something like that, and that is obviously out the window now. But I do wonder, like, there's already going to be a, you know, we talked in previous episodes about how when you win a championship, you win a championship, and nothing, no one can ever take that away from you. But this is such an extraordinary circumstance where there will be an undeniable asterisk on whoever wins the title in for the 2019-2020 season. And so
are you happy about that, or you're just saying that's how it's going to be remembered?
Well, unless the Boston Celtics win it all, then there's going to be just this humongous asterisk on whoever takes home the crown. And what you have is, like, how much do you want to deviate from the norm if you don't have to, is basically what I'm trying to say. Because, like,
right. So if you grow
the asterisk to a point and you blow it out where it's just like it overtakes the actual gameplay in terms of just the conversation, like, what are we even doing? You know,
no,
what I mean?
I got you. You're in Microsoft Word right now, and the asterisk is size 12 font. And what you're worried is if you change all these format and you do all these other different weird things, and everyone's like, what do you mean? Wait a minute. Orlando played the Lakers? Like, that makes no sense. That all of a sudden that font size gets blown up to like 72, and it's like really glaring, and it's kind of hanging over everything. That's a pretty compelling argument. I mean, I guess it comes down to how serious were they thinking about reseeding before all this, right? Because it's a very convenient way to, like, drop in a new playoff format, right? If this is how it's going to be going forward, it's like, oh, we're doing it as a test case, wink, wink. And then from every year going forward, it's like, all right, now we've got a reseeded playoffs, which was something that, you know, it's one of my hobby horses. I would love that. But I don't know if we're going to get there. So let me ask you, if you were a player right now, do you have enough information to decide whether you would play or sit home? And if not, what would be your sort of deal breaker information? Like, what could convince you to go versus what would lead you to pull out? I mean, we haven't really heard of any player saying, you know, yet, oh, I'm not going. That could happen. And what are those kinds of characteristics for you?
There was a report over the past few days that kind of trickled out where Joe Ingles said that he was pondering retirement when COVID-19 was kind of at its apex or nearing its apex. But he's since walked that back. Those comments were made months ago. And so that's really the only player I can think of who has said that they would not feel safe playing. I don't know how they feel. Some players feel privately. It seems that, you know, on that call that a lot of the superstars were on, there was a lot of momentum to actually play, and no one really wants to continue the suspension of the season. For me, if I was a player, I mean, yeah, I would play. I mean, I know that the games are going to take place whether I do or not. And so it seems really trite, but I'd be letting my teammates down. I'd be letting my organization down. I'd be letting fans down. And that alone would be an easy way to talk myself into it if I had any suspicion that I wouldn't really want to, or any drawbacks to competing. Like, I it would be pretty easy for me. Also, I wonder what the financial, which you have to account for, I wonder what the financial consequences would be if I chose not to play.
So, are you going outside your apartment right now? Like, basically, are you wearing masks? I mean, how are you limiting your travel and your movement? I mean, what's your daily life like right now?
For me, Michael Pena in 2020, yeah. I am wearing a mask at all times. I'm very, social distancing. I'm taking it very seriously is the short way to put it.
Okay, so I guess my point here is, Michael, you sound pretty confident you're ready to come back, but what if you had to get on a flight tomorrow? Right? I mean, what if we're playing these games and what if you're starting practices in 3 weeks? There's not going to be any masks. You're going to have to, you're going to have to change everything about your current routine. You're going to be exposing yourself in ways that lots of other Americans aren't exposing themselves. Are you sure you're still on board for all these games, or you're just going to feel the peer pressure and responsibility to do it?
I would succumb to peer pressure.
Very interesting.
Well, I know that the next question you're going to ask me is what I would do as a reporter, as myself, just if I had the opportunity to cover it. And I think that that's obviously it's a different circumstance. But I honestly think that if I had the chance, I would go cover it. And at this, I would feel very weird, and I would feel uneasy about just being around people and writing about the outcomes of basketball games. But as a journalist, I would also, like, looking back 20 years from now, I'd probably regret it if I didn't go, because it's literally a once in a I'd be alive, yes. But it's also, like, literally a once in a lifetime opportunity and a once in a lifetime experience to be in this, like, bubble in Orlando. Watch, it would be weird, but it would be totally unique. And yes, I hope I would survive the experience first and foremost, but confident that I would. It's something that I would probably want to do.
Yeah, it's really tricky, man. It's funny, I've been weighing that question too. Like, I spent so much time in Vegas over the years covering summer leagues that if Vegas was the venue, and I already would know, here's what hotel I could stay at so I don't have to go on an elevator, right? Mm-hmm. I know I could stay away from the crowds. I already know what restaurants I could order, get food from. I would have a level of comfort factor there that I don't think I would have, because I went to Disney World once when I was a kid, but I never went to this ESPN compound that they're building and everything, or that's been built, that they're going to use. And so it would all be new and foreign to me. I feel like the anxiety level would be much higher because of that. Now, granted, we should have mentioned that the case counts in that area are pretty low, all things considered. So that's good, for sure. I mean, it's not like you're dropping this thing in the middle of, you know, Manhattan or Brooklyn, you know, where obviously Sweet. There's been a, yeah, well, no disrespect, but, like, I think you guys are sort of known right now as kind of the epicenter of this virus in the country. So yeah. I just think that those, just walking through the mental exercise of, like, oh yeah, I'd be more open to it if it was Vegas than Orlando, leads me to believe that there are going to be some players who have hesitations here, and then they're going to need to really feel reassured and comfortable. And maybe if you're going with your team, you do feel that level of safety and security, which is sort of ironic because, like, ultimately those are the people who are probably the most likely to actually get you sick because of the whole closed quarters thing. I think the other question for media members is, are you going to have access to anything, right? Or is it just going to be a televised post-game press conference? Obviously, locker rooms are not going to be open. you know, what's the journalistic benefit of being there in person other than the experience side, which, you know, you're going to be able to get that bubble experience in like 72 hours. And then now you've got two more months of playoffs to cover, right? So I do think there's some trade-offs there, you know, potentially pros and cons of just staying home, sitting it out, and, you know, not increasing your risk versus, you know, going down there, you know, treating it like it's, you know, the assignment of your lifetime, only to find out that, no, actually, you're not getting within 200 feet of anybody. You're just sitting in the top of an empty gym watching these guys go 5-on-5, just, you know?
Just all risk, no reward. that's not what you want. There's just bringing it back real quick to basketball for a second and, you know, talking about asterisks on what would be different about this playoff setting as opposed to every single one in the league's history. Something I've thought about that is very obvious but is very weird is just the fact that there would be no home court advantage. And so the whole point of the seedings and the whole point of the regular season is to get home court advantage, to win more games, than as many games as you can, and get a seeding, and if hopefully you're in the top four and that you'll get you know, home court in the first round, and that is ostensibly an advantage for you. But that just completely gets wiped away. So I don't know. Do you have any thoughts about like how you can give a team that had a better regular season some type of advantage over their opponent? Or is it just kind of like tough?
No, yeah, you let them play the lower Eastern Conference teams, you know, who honestly don't even deserve to be in this thing. just kidding. No, the home court advantage thing is a huge deal. I mean, right now we're supposed to be watching Lakers-Clippers in LA, right? And instead, if we're lucky, we get to watch Lakers-Clippers, this brand new, amazing rivalry, first time they've ever played in the playoffs. Instead of seven games at Staples, it's going to be seven games in Orlando. I mean, in an empty gym. Like, that is just rough from an experiential standpoint. I think the bigger factor is how do you create a watchable television product in that environment, right? I've been surprised, like, you know, they put the cardboard cutouts up in the soccer stands. It looks better than empty seats, man. I know it's kind of phony, but like if you're just watching the game, you're used to it. Obviously, it's weird. Everybody's going to laugh about it. It does look better. In terms of piping the noise in, I know there's a lot of people who are saying, oh, never pipe noise in, blah, blah, blah. I think they're better off doing that too. I mean, there's a lot of unnecessary noise.
Yeah, guess what? That already happens.
Right, in the NBA stadium experience. So just try to make it as close as possible. I mean, you know, almost approach this like you're a, you know, a movie director on a limited budget, right? It's like, well, we don't have enough money for 20,000 extras. Well, do we have enough money for 20,000 cardboard heads? Let's do that, right? You know, like you have to kind of get creative here to make it as realistic as possible. So I would encourage them to do those kinds of things just for the TV audience, not even for the players, but just for the viewing audience at home. Because ultimately, you're going to need to keep people's attention on these games. The thing is, if you are going to run these playoffs, they have to be watchable. The whole reason why you're doing this is the television revenue, right? If your games are whack, right? If it's like Toronto versus Orlando in an empty gym and it looks like Summer League, no one's watching that, and you're not getting your revenue checks coming in like you would hope. So I think that is a really important key aspect, and that's actually one where I trust the people at ESPN, the NBA, and TNT to figure that part out, because this is what they do, right? And they've been doing it for a long time. All right, Michael, I think that we're ready to kind of maybe shift gears here. Any final thoughts about the NBA's bubble? I guess I should have asked you the most important question first. Are you excited about this? Are you like anxiously counting the days until we have this back? I'll be honest, as a guy who like lives and breathes basketball, my first reaction was really the mixed feelings. Like, is this a good idea? This doesn't seem great. Like, they have some major questions left to answer. Is it worth it? How, you know, and maybe some of those mixed feelings will recede once, you know, they clear things up like the formatting and the testing, and maybe I'll feel more comfortable a few weeks down the line. But I was not like pumping my fist, you know, like I just hit a game winner over Brian Russell when they announced this over the weekend. I had more of a sensation of uneasiness.
I 100% am with you. I'm personally leaning a little more towards the cautious side and the, you know, do we really need this as a society side? And I just, through the past, I don't even know, 6, 7, 8 weeks, whatever it's been, I've just not really even been that interested in updates and developments about the NBA season or professional sports in general and what leagues are doing. Like, I don't, maybe it is because of where I live and how severe I'm seeing it firsthand, but it's like, I just can't bring myself to caring all that much. And I think that that feeling has dissipated a little bit as this whole thing has kind of gone on and you're enduring it in real time. But yeah, I don't think anyone was pumping their fist, and I certainly was not either.
All right, let's shift gears here. I hear what you're saying completely. We got some great questions from the Open Floor Globe. They emailed us, openfloormail@gmail.com, openfloormail@gmail.com. Brandon from LA is already looking forward to that offseason, Michael. That might not come until October. He writes, with all that's going on right now and the uncertainty around the salary cap this summer, is this the time for a no-name GM to become a household name, or maybe for the next Tim Connolly to stand up? What if Rob Pelinka has another monster summer? He could put himself on another level from a reputation standpoint. Or can Bob Myers cement his Hall of Fame status? So Brandon is tracking the executives, like maybe some people would track the superstars. And I'm curious, when you're looking ahead to this summer, where it is going to be crazy. I mean, everybody's going to probably try to shed salary, and they might have to, you know, change the luxury tax situation so that, you know, owners aren't, you know, completely, you know, forced to pay just obscene bills with the lack of revenue coming in and everything else. Is there a GM who you're willing to kind of call your shot and say, this guy's about to have a big summer? What do you think?
I don't know, because the rules of the CBA are just in flux so much that it's hard to look at someone's cap sheet now and see who has a major advantage, and knowing what players are going to do in free agency going forward in 2020 and 2021, and just what the financial status is going to be of the league long term. But I have a really underrated, or I guess underrated isn't the right word, probably just super overlooked candidate here. And I picked him because no one even knows what he looks like, so I'm really going under the radar. But Brian Wright, who is the general manager of the San Antonio Spurs, I'm going with him just because I feel like the San Antonio Spurs are in this humongous state of transition. And this is an opportunity for him to make a name for himself. So he could completely blow up what is already, you know, a middling team. He could move LaMarcus Aldridge and figure out a way to move on from DeMar DeRozan. I mean, the Brooklyn Nets and the Houston Rockets would probably have interest in Aldridge, I would think, maybe. That's just a name that I have that I think would be interesting in terms of just kind of like the no-name general managers who are trying to assert themselves, because as cemented as Greg Popovich and RC Buford have been at the top of the San Antonio Spurs for so long, I wonder if someone like Brian Wright could come in and kind of establish himself with a big move or two.
I love that call. I mean, that's out of left field for you for sure, but they were already at that crossroads, right? And I think that the teams that were in the middle of transitions now kind of, it's almost like a rocket booster to those transitions, right? Because now you have like the perfect excuse. If you want to strip this entire thing down, you could be like, sorry, guys, like tell your fans, you know, this isn't a normal year. We're dealing with COVID. We've got a plan for the next 10 years. I mean, you have pretty much cover to do almost anything that you want. Mm-hmm. What about the Knicks front office, right? I mean, weren't they positioning potentially to, you know, have a new era? Are they going to gamble big on a superstar, maybe trade for somebody like Chris Paul? You know, they have flexibility maybe financially that a lot of organizations don't, because remember, they signed all those guys to one-year contracts last summer. I mean, they also are potentially going to have a pretty good draft pick, right? I mean, is there a scenario where the Knicks' new backcourt next year is Chris Paul and LaMelo Ball? Like, does that get you the Paul-Ball combo? What do you think? Like, the perfect mentor for a new rising superstar-level player, a guy who says he wants to be the GOAT in 15 years, Michael? What do you think?
I think that as long as James Dolan is the owner, I just wonder what financial hit he has taken and what appetite he would have for absorbing Chris Paul's just monstrous contract going. I don't know how all of this has changed the calculus there. But that's an interesting one.
He did sell the forum in Inglewood, you know, to Steve Ballmer for cash, basically. So if he can use
that's a good sign. Yeah.
If he uses that Inglewood money to just like pay, you know, to as like a bridge loan to himself over the course of the pandemic. I mean, the other team really to watch, I think, is Houston, man. I mean, their owner was on a panel at the White House, essentially, I mean, requesting, begging, whatever word you want to use, for some small business PPP money that he definitely did not qualify for. You know, basically his hat's out in D.C., just kind of, you know, passing it around, hoping for a little bit of help. When you're an organization that has two players who are max, super max level guys in Westbrook and Harden, and, you know, you've been already embroiled in this whole China controversy and everything else going back to the Hong Kong situation, that could be, you know, kind of the flip side here. Maybe there could be a GM who makes his name by peeling off one of those stars from Houston, or, you know, finds a way to get in on some of Houston's role players and put his team over the top. Just a couple situations to keep your eye on. Did you have any others that you wanted to nominate?
Yeah, I have a couple others just because, you know, you just talked about the opportunity to peel away a superstar. I mean, Tommy Shepard with the Washington Wizards, obviously the dance that organization has been playing with Bradley Beal over the past 12 months or so, if you were ever going to move him, I know he's been in the news with the Brooklyn Nets, but if you're ever going to move him and not, you know, feel a backlash from the fan base, I think this would be a pretty convenient time. What do you think about Tommy?
Well, that's an interesting one. I mean, Beal has just said, I don't want to go the whole way. And his agent comes back. Anytime there's a rumor, it doesn't matter who wants to start it, Bartlestein's out there saying, shut this thing down. And I think part of the reason why is that Beal's been very active in the DC community. And he also is basically, you know, starting a family. Like, he's had a couple of young children here recently. And so it would be a really annoying time to like have to pick up shop, find a new house, and move just within his own personal life. And if we're being honest, he's got a pretty good life, Michael. He's making like $30 million to go home in April every year. You know, it's like there are worse existences out there. And he's also kind of become the man there in D.C. It's his team, for better or worse, at least until Wall comes back. And, you know, is he motivated, you know, at all costs to go win a title and want to join up a super team? I mean, he's never kind of given that messaging. He's more been in that, you know, I'm happy here, I'm a loyal guy, and I want to be here as long as possible. I think if you're in that situation, you know, the Wizards kind of answer to him a little bit. You know what I mean? He's not so good that he's going to get you some crazy, you know, Paul George-like package. I mean, I think if they would get something like that, they would, you know, trade him against his will, right? But I do think that when you're trying to build a culture, you've got young guys, it's, you know, first-time GM and everything else, it's a tricky spot to be in. You know, trying to pull the trigger on a trade like that when he's made it clear he doesn't want to go, that's difficult. You know, I guess I would wait that one out at least a year. They've also been saying, hey, we're going to give this a shot with Wall and Beal, and I don't like that idea at all. They're kind of stuck with Wall, you know, in his contract no matter what. To me, if you do trade Beal, then it's just super awkward because Wall is like your only remaining veteran, and like, what's the point of that team? So I feel like there's a lot of conditions that are going to keep Beal there for one more year.
No, that's fair. I think that I agree, and with what you said about them needing a Godfather offer to kind of pull the trigger on something like that. But who knows? I mean, just talking about the Rockets and bringing them up again, and just bringing up their desperation. Like, if they, you know, were willing to throw in their next like five first round picks or something staggered over, you know, skipping a year every year to make it legal. Like, I just, who knows, man? Who knows?
No, I hear you. I just think the Rockets are going to be sellers, not buyers. And I think that's tough. I think that, I mean, if any fan base needs to be sweating during this pandemic, it's got to be them, right? Because they were right there not that long ago. They have this weird transition season. Then all of a sudden, it's just clear that their owner is just completely up a creek from a financial standpoint. And, I mean, you don't see Joe Lacob going to D.C., you know, asking for small business loans. You don't see, you know, Steve Ballmer, you know, doing that kind of a thing. So it's just, it's, you know, by NBA standards, very extraordinary behavior from their leader. and it would make me nervous. Just bottom line, if I was one of their fans. All right, let's shift gears here. We got a question from Gary. He writes, "Greetings from England. I'm really enjoying the podcast. After the success of The Last Dance, I thought about a documentary I would like to see made. The San Antonio Spurs from the 1997 to 2020, drafting Tim Duncan, Manu Ginobili, Tony Parker, 5 NBA championships, Kawhi Leonard leaving, and then maybe missing the playoffs for the first time in 20 years. I feel like not much is really realized from the Spurs, so that could make it a good series. It's the Popovich years and none of the ego, but there's some great stories to be told." So, Michael, I'm curious, like, I mean, this is sort of one of those holy grail ideas, right? It's the modern dynasty that nobody ever talks about. If you contrast the way the Lakers, you know, the Shaq and Kobe split, or the Kobe and Powell reunion, you know, wind up how much attention that gets versus what we saw from Duncan for 20 years, it's night and day, obviously. I think a lot of people here in the United States, Gary, would say, oh, that's never going to happen. Popovich wouldn't let it happen. Duncan has no interest in self-promoting. You know, just forget about this idea right off the top. But Michael, I'm curious, is there any way you could make Gary's dreams come true? What would need to happen for this project to get off the ground?
I'm a little pessimistic. I mean, their entire ethos, the Spurs' entire ethos, was selflessness and the elimination of ego. So I just find it hard to believe, like, that Greg Popovich and Tim Duncan would sit around and talk about how great they were for hours on end. But
yeah, I mean, Popovich might sit around and talk about how great Duncan was, but Duncan would probably, like, boringly defer credit to Popovich. I think the main problem you've got here is Duncan. He is never going to, like, regale you with tales of, like, how much he hated Kevin Garnett, or how sweet it was to beat Shaq in the playoffs, or, like, the kind of stuff that really was the gold from Jordan in that documentary. He's just never going to engage on that stuff, right?
No, it's just not his personality. It's not his makeup. I mean, I would be really interested in, you know, going back to, I forget, what year was it when Duncan almost went to the Orlando Magic? He was very close. Doc Rivers has spoken about this when he was the head coach of Orlando at the time. But, like, going back,
was it 03?
It could have been, yeah. It was a very, I mean, he was close to going. And, I mean, that's, like, one of the great all-time what-ifs that no one really talks about now. But hearing Duncan,
it was 2000. Sorry about that. They got out of their contracts a little bit earlier back then.
Okay, wonderful. So if he would go back and maybe talk about stuff like that, and if the organization discussed, I guess, how they found Manu, how they found Tony, the confidence that they had in those guys, bringing them along, it could be super interesting, for sure. I'm with you. It would be, I can't think of, honestly, a more compelling team that just, you know, has had so much success and been in the NBA consciousness for so long that we know so little about relative to, like, you know, the Lakers with the Shaq and Kobe drama and all that. So I don't know. I mean, there's obviously stories that have not been told, really compelling ones. And if you were able to kind of drag that out of some key characters, then the doc would be tremendous. But I just don't think that that's possible.
Well, Manu and Tony would be good, especially Manu, because he's just, like, so honest and just, you know, wears his heart on his sleeve. And I think the longer that he gets away from those Spurs glory days, the more he's going to cherish those times, right? So the question is, can you build this whole thing around Manu? Tony's always been pretty interesting. He's got a little bit of a wry sense of humor. And obviously he was there for every step of the way. So maybe he can be sort of like your Horace Grant type snitch in this program, you know, just sort of like get all the good details and you can kind of build the stories around. I don't know. Maybe one way to do this, Gary, would be to focus on the 2013 and 2014 years, losing in heartbreaking fashion and kind of perplexing fashion with Popovich taking Duncan off the court and not getting that key rebound that sets up the Ray Allen three, and then coming back on the revenge mission and just, like, laying waste to the entire league in the playoffs, you know, beating some really, really good teams handily in that 2014 playoff run. It's an amazing group with players from all over the world. You could get sort of like, it's kind of the peak Spurs from a globalization standpoint. You know, they've got guys just all these different countries represented on that team. Their offense was at a very, very high level. The key strategic shift to, you know, having Boris Diaw playing, you know, big minutes, kind of stretching things out. To me, if you focus on that 2-year stretch, kept it to, you know, pretty much to basketball and just pitched it as like Duncan's revenge mission against LeBron, you could probably get enough to carry like a 1 or 2 hour movie. I just don't think you're ever going to get 10 hours from these guys, and certainly not 10 hours for like a,
well,
you know, a general audience.
For sure. I now that I think about this even more, what I would actually, and what I think everyone listening would really want to see and listen and observe is just the insight of what happened with Kawhi Leonard. And that is something that will obviously, that's impossible. That's just not going to happen for years and years and years. And the deterioration of that relationship and really what went into it. And if they could get like Kawhi Leonard to sit down and open up, which, I mean, good luck, then that would be the, like the primo number one documentary possibility of the, in, like the number one iteration of what we're discussing right now. But that's just, that's even more impossible than everything we've already kind of discussed here.
For sure. We have another documentary insight from Thaddeus, our old friend. He writes, when you guys threw out that question about the player documentary that you really didn't want to see, only one name came to my mind. Come on, who's got the skills to be an all-time great, the yes men around him to blindly help him make a documentary, and a chip on his shoulder because he always feels like he's underappreciated? Guys, it's Kevin Durant. Can you imagine how whiny and attention-craving that documentary would be? How many times would he say that people didn't get it, or they never understood his greatness, or that he didn't deal with the media and just wanted to hoop? Add in there, there'd be an entire episode of him complaining why it wasn't weak for him to leave his team to ride with one of the greatest of all time. Add in that he wasn't happy collecting rings with that same greatest team of all time. Add in that there'd be a Kyrie team-up, courting Kyrie, talking to New York, and joining up in Brooklyn. We'd get like 30 minutes of Kyrie quotes that you know he'd be happy to give. So maybe it would be ironically entertaining. Oh boy, oh boy. Thaddeus, I feel like a lot of subliminal shots towards me in terms of all the arguments I've done on KD's behalf over the years. So thanks for that. Michael, could you salvage a Kevin Durant documentary? Is there any way you could see that actually being good? Or are you bowing to Thaddeus on this one? Is he right?
I considered this a few weeks ago, and I just don't think there's much value in seeing Durant speak about himself because it's already such an oversaturated topic. I mean, he has his Twitter account, he has Instagram, he's done countless interviews in numerous forums, he has a TV show, I guess the boardroom's on YouTube, I don't even, it's like he...
ESPN Plus.
Sure, ESPN Plus. So he's already kind of, he opens his mind and he lets people know what he's thinking constantly. And so I just don't know what he could tell us that we don't already know while his story is still being told. So it's kind of like him tirelessly attempting to correct a narrative that isn't likely to ever change. And that's just not very interesting to me.
Yeah, I got you. I mean, I think, look, I mean, it's probably too late to redo the narratives on him. There was so much hope and promise for him from a narrative standpoint right up until the Oklahoma City decision. And he had so much goodwill. A documentary about those early Thunder teams would be an incredible time capsule. But I think everyone watching it would be like, wow, well, you know what happened afterwards, right? It was just like,
yeah, they would hate him even more. Yeah, exactly.
I know. It's so tough, man. I don't know. Maybe if enough time passed, people won't be so sick of the I'm misunderstood stuff that Thaddeus sounds like he is sick of. And there will be the opportunity to kind of paint a more complicated picture of a misunderstood athlete who was a real genius on the court, but just never found a way to connect with people or couldn't, I guess, maintain it or keep it lasting, or was a victim of circumstances or poor decisions. However you wanted to paint that movie, to me, don't rule it out forever, Thaddeus. You might come back around. I think Kevin Durant's game, by the way, is going to hold up great on the YouTube tapes. If you get to, you know, 2030, 2035, and you're going back and watching Kevin Durant, you know, in his prime years, I feel like there's been a real revival for guys like Tracy McGrady here, and probably because he's on television, so he gets a little bit more attention and love, and all these people are coming back and kind of rewriting Tracy McGrady's history. I mean, KD was just a better all-around player, flat out, by a lot. He's going to go down as, I would guess, one of the top, you know, 10 or 15 players of all time. He had an incredibly exciting style. I think the basketball stuff is going to hold up great, and people are going to say, wow, this guy was, you know, a real modernizing element, you know, a player who's almost 7 foot tall who can handle the ball. I think that stuff is, Yeah, he's going to be remembered fondly for that, and his highlights are going to appeal to people for years and years and years. The personality stuff, though, is a legit challenge, and you might have to just sort of, you know, let time pass to heal those wounds. All right, we've got a question from Jesse. He writes, "We've all enjoyed watching the characters in The Last Dance reflect upon their successes and failures with varying degrees of arrogance and humility." So you're going to have your choice here, Michael. Arrogance or humility, all right? Jesse asks us, take a moment to slip on your favorite Jordans and reflect on your own body of written and spoken work. Is there a sentence you wish you could take back, i.e. a hot take that ended up being completely frozen? Or is there a sentence you are most proud of, i.e. a unique turn of phrase or a fitting metaphor? My favorite line of Ben's was a random observation from a few years ago. He described a player who lacked defensive acumen as appearing more lost than a four-year-old in a sleeping bag. I don't know why that one line stayed with me, but it still makes me chuckle to this day. Jesse, thank you for sending that in. It was very nice of you to add that as a postscript. I don't remember saying that, Michael, but it sounds like something I would say, and I appreciate him bringing back the greatest hit. So let me know, would you prefer to be arrogant, humble, or both? Do you have a favorite or a least favorite?
First of all, I'm devastated that you don't remember saying that, and I kind of don't believe you, because I just think that you know who it was about, and you just don't want to call them out again, because clearly you were taking shots.
I'm always taking shots, Michael. That's the thing. I mean, you do this long enough, they just come out sideways sometimes. You're not even aware. You know, the gun just goes off. What can I say? I really honestly don't remember. Do you remember who I said it about? Is that what you're trying to say?
No, I don't. I mean, there's a lot of different contenders that would pop to the top of my head, but I don't know. I did not ever hear you say that. It is a great line, though, I will say.
My favorite phrase that I can remember just offhand that I go back to quite a bit is a similar vein where it's another, you know, guy struggling defensively. So Nikola Jokic, he was trying to defend in space during the playoffs and really struggling with it. And I described him as basically having severed legs and wearing ice skates. So the phrase I used was he looks like he's stumps on skates when he gets out, you know, trying to defend in space. And that image of him just like bumbling around and like how painful that would be if you were in stumps on skates. And I think it's the alliteration that makes it stick with me too, Michael. That one I am kind of proud of. Probably shouldn't be. It's a little bit disgusting now that I'm really breaking it down. But it's also just quick, and you know exactly what it's, you know, descriptive. It's visual. You know what I mean if I say a player is in stumps on skates out there defending in space. So that's one that I like. Do you have any favorite lines?
I mean, it's, you don't want to like go back and kind of pat yourself on the back too much. I did write something very recently, a piece for GQ about Bill Russell's autobiography, Second Wind, and I had a line in there that I did like a lot, so I'm just going to reread it on the pod because I was asked to. Writing as a stern, skeptical misanthrope, more stubborn than an oak tree getting yanked from the ground, Russell also treats self-discovery as the roadmap to reinvention. That I like that line, and it was like me trying to sum up. I mean, I had in thinking about Russell, he just kind of conjures big like redwood oak trees that are just really difficult to move, that have been around forever, that are super stubborn. So to kind of, I'm like, I don't even know how to like describe myself in the thought process of writing out loud, but I'm glad that it came out the way that it did.
Yeah, you did better on page than you did on the pod, Mike, gotta say. No, I'm just kidding. No, look, I mean, we're not really, we haven't had as much time to practice our self-promotion, you know, right, as guys like Michael Jordan or Scottie Pippen or Phil Jackson. We haven't necessarily honed our Zen Buddhism philosophies. It was a great line and also a great piece. I really enjoyed the contrast you drew between Bill Russell's self-reflection, this idea that he's going to dig inside and, you know, in this book that you've read, and expose himself in ways that Michael Jordan was just never, ever going to do. It's like all of the calculation that was baked into Jordan's project is just apparently non-existent in that book. It made me want to read the book for sure, and people should start with your piece, no question. It was very well written. And that line jumped out to me as a guy who happens to hug trees regularly, Michael, and really enjoys trees. Any tree allusion catches my interest. All right, we got to flip this around because you're so uncomfortable patting yourself on the back, Michael. So let's have a little humble pie here. No more arrogance. What do you say? What's the biggest regret of your writing career? Do you have one, a line that you wish you could take back?
I've discussed this on the pod before. I mean, right off the top, I don't really believe in regrets just as a writer, because like, we're going to take shots. Well, and
are you like a character on The Real World? I mean, what is this?
I mean, what I try to do is go outside of the there's just all these different narratives that are in place, and what I like to do is to try to like carve my own lane. And so I'm gonna be wrong a lot, because a lot of the common narratives are common narratives because they are correct. And so when you try to deviate, you kind of get you stumble a little bit. And so the one time that really pops out to me is just this piece I wrote about Steph Curry that I've already mentioned on the pod before. So if you've already listened to it, I apologize. But basically, I wrote a piece a couple years ago saying that, or declaring that, Steph Curry was in decline. And he is still incredible. And I guess you could parse whether or not he is as good today or as good last season as he was 3 years ago or whatever. But like, the backlash to that piece, I feel like, was deserved. And even though I was fair in what I was trying to say and articulate, it came across as me just like using numbers to form this argument that really didn't even need to be made. So that's like the biggest quote unquote regret that I've had.
Well, look, I think you might be the first person who's ever been ratioed to say that they deserved it, Michael. I think that is, you know, just the pinnacle of being humble. I'm really, really impressed by that. I just want to say, with regard to this question, Jesse, you asking it really got me thinking, because bottom line, we make hundreds of predictions on this show over the course of a year. You know, if anybody's actually doing better than 50-50, I'd be shocked, right? I mean, that's just kind of the nature of the beast. But as human beings, we're always going to remember our own hits and forget our own misses, right? And so what's great about the Open Floor Globe is that, you know, they could always, you know, keep us honest and say, oh, you screwed this up, you screwed that up, why are you overlooking, you know, this player or that player, and, you know, this guy's going to prove you wrong. If you didn't have that, if you did just get yourself into a bubble where you're only remembering your own hits, it would absolutely distort things, and it would allow you to write your own version of history. And so I think that this is what some people are pushing back with on the documentary, is that maybe those critics' voices weren't heard loudly enough, Michael. And I think it's a really valid point, because, you know, ultimately, like, as I was thinking about this question, it's a lot easier for me to remember the moments that made me happy or chuckle, like the stumps on skates thing or other jokes along the way, or, oh, yeah, I got DeMar DeRozan in that battle, right? But of course, there's been a million predictions that were completely wrong. Never gave the Raptors a chance last year, all the way right down to the very end of winning the title. And I think in general, I'm pretty conservative with my predictions. Like, I don't make, you know, wild, outlandish, like outside the box title picks. I usually kind of stick to the script on MVPs and everything else. But I'm pretty sure I've picked the wrong MVP like the last 6 years. I don't think I've gotten MVP
really
once. Yeah, I mean, I really don't think I've gotten MVP right once, Michael. It's pretty bad.
Wait. Can we? Okay, we got to stop here. You didn't pick Giannis to win MVP?
No, last year, no, I didn't. I forget who I even picked. I have to go back and check the record, but no.
Tatum?
No, not Tatum. That's a good one for people to rub in our face, because we're just roasting Tatum from Summer League, and he's come back with a vengeance. So maybe that's my biggest regret, is I do try to like not judge people too early and not try to judge them on their best day or their worst day. And there's been a few from Summer League. It's just like brutal. at the same time, there's been other, you know, guys like Fultz who got like 15 second chances from everybody in the media. And it was just killing me that nobody would just kind of speak honestly about him. I caught some flack for how direct I was for saying that he shouldn't get to wear a chain with his jersey number if he never actually played, because it's just like, what does that number even represent? People said that was insensitive, and I understand. I caught a lot of heat for that. I was right on that one, but, you know, maybe right on the merits and wrong, you know, wrong from a human standpoint. But look, we could do this all day. I think the bigger takeaway here, Jesse, is that, look, everybody's right, everybody's wrong. It's always important to remember that, and it's also important to acknowledge that any of us individually are going to warp our own story if we're allowed to tell it. And that's a major takeaway, not only from this podcast, in terms of your role as an audience for keeping us honest, but also for your role as a viewer in watching any documentary to make sure that you feel like you're getting a fair story all the way around. All right, we got another question here from Mark in Montreal. He writes, losing in 1999 might have been the fire that would have given Michael Jordan motivation for the next 2 to 3 years. Think about it. When he lost in 95, it brought him back with a new mission. But losing in 99 could have done the same thing. Yes, Jerry Krause might have had to find a new rebounder, a new coach, or a young replacement for Pippen. Well, that's a big ask there, Mark. But he goes on to write, that is what a GM is supposed to do anyway. What you don't do is let the GOAT walk away when he still wanted to play. That is just wrong. And to all the people who say he should have quit with that storybook ending, I say let the man himself decide. It's not up to the fans or pundits to tell the greats when to walk away. If Jordan had stayed in shape and had not taken 2 to 3 years off, he would have been capable of playing at a high level for the next 2 to 4 years easily. I know everyone talks about how Michael hated to lose, but he actually was a pretty good loser in those series against the Pistons. He shook hands after the losses and gave them credit. I think what he really would have wanted was to stay in shape to test himself against the wave of young talent, even if his team wasn't up to the dynastic summits of the past. Michael, I guess I'm curious here. Jordan explains why he's mad at Krause. He said during the season he wouldn't return without Phil. Phil clearly wanted out, as we've described, and there was really no scenario where he was going to come back. And so that left Jordan without any other plan. I guess to push back against Mark's argument in this email, doesn't MJ deserve kind of a lot of the blame here for how it ended, or at least a portion of it? If it was as simple as him wanting to play, he could have surveyed his options and kept a more open mind. But by boxing him into this idea of I'm not playing without Phil and never really considering playing anywhere else besides Chicago, didn't he kind of just shoot the hostage? Like, wasn't this whole thing done before he even had enough time to regret it?
I guess so. I mean, it's tough to go back and kind of judge Jordan from that era and compare it to, you know, player empowerment and what we're seeing now. And so if Jordan was obsessed with winning titles, which I'm sure he was, and Chicago just was not the situation for him, and, you know, we've talked about this in previous episodes about where he could have gone to win. Like, I don't know how he could have attracted players to play with him, or if he even had the types of relationships with guys, with his contemporaries, to like build a super team on the fly. I just don't know what the permutations would have been at a time like that. But I get what you're saying for sure. And yeah, publicly saying that you don't want to play for anyone but Phil was not the greatest, smartest decision.
Right. Like, you're a guy who has all this leverage. You're bigger than the sport. You're bigger than your team. Obviously, you don't want to leave. But like, if things are that dire, at some point you have to walk away, right? Like, haven't you ever been in that situation, like in life, like whether it's a negotiation or, you know, maybe... you know, it's like your photography class when you were in high school, Michael, where you're just like, enough is enough, right? I'm out. I'm going to go do journalism. Like,
I was the Jordan of that photography class.
Right. And so that's kind of what I'm saying is, like, this guy had an unbelievable amount of leverage, and there are all these other teams out there. Certainly anyone would have killed to have Jordan. Why you basically, you know, have this stare down, you know, playing chicken with Krause, who's, you know, kind of irrational, as the emailer described, and allow that to dictate the end of your career. If you really still wanted to play, you know, you could have found another way. And I think ultimately we need to put that back on Jordan. It's not just a Bulls thing. If it was all about keeping his career going no matter what, he would have found another way. And by the way, he did, because he played for the Wizards a few years later.
And that was a total disaster. But like maybe Jordan is misremembering. I mean, the Jordan of today is misremembering how he felt at the time. Maybe he wanted to walk away. And like, who knows? Like, I'm sure there's a lot of different things that Jordan exaggerated or was not willing to be 100% forthcoming about in those present day interviews during The Last Dance that kind of try to twist the narrative of what actually happened 22 years ago.
For sure. He probably just forgot how tired he was, man. I mean, that happens to me too. Like, when you're in the moment and you're physically exhausted and, like, you know, just the idea of, you know, the next step is just so difficult to even imagine, and you tap out, and then, like, you know, 2 years later you've got your energy back, you're like, wow, like, why did I tap out? I could do this. This is, you know, one of those things where time kind of changes perspective. Hey, Michael, we've got a bunch more awesome questions that we didn't get to, so we're going to bring those back later this week. Guys, I also want to announce we have an extra bonus episode coming to you this week. It's an interview I did with author and writer Jack McCallum. He's got a new podcast series called The Dream Team Tapes, which are a really fun behind-the-scenes look with exclusive interviews. Guys like Michael Jordan, Larry Bird, Magic Johnson. The interviews were done for Jack's book about the Dream Team, you know, almost a decade ago now. But the audio is really fun. You're going to hear these guys in their own words. They're speaking very candidly, and they kind of go through the major steps of that run from the Dream Team. I asked Jack about the Tournament of Americas, which happened to take place in Portland, Oregon. He had some great behind-the-scenes insight on that part of the process. And, of course, the famous practice in Monte Carlo. Some of the, you know, the other just personality conflicts that were developing a little bit. And most fun of all, Michael, I asked him about Christian Laettner and how weird it must have been to be Laettner on that team. And he had some interesting things to say there, too. So, guys, check that podcast out. It will be released this week, I believe, Thursday. Michael and I will be back on Friday. All right, Michael, they can find us on Apple Podcasts by searching for Open Floor. That's two words. When you find our page, scroll down. It will say rate and review. Tap 5 stars. It's just that easy to help us spread the word. Michael is on Instagram and Twitter at Michael V as in Victor Pina. I'm on Instagram at Ben.Golliver. On Twitter at Ben Golliver. All right, Michael, until later this week, I will talk to you.
Talk soon, Ben.